Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyau from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
And I'm Michael Isgoff.
And this is Spy Talk. Mike. Another yes. crazy week in the intelligence world. What is the worst thing that has happened? Let's start with that.
Yeah. Well, I really was struck by the firing of the general counsel of the National Security Agency, April Das, a woman who I have known in the past. She was a staffer for Senator Mark Warner on the Senate Intelligence Committee. That seems to have been her sin that gets her fired in her career job at the NSA. But the part that interested me the most is what brought this to the attention of the powers that be to take this radical action. It was our friend Laura Loomer, who, if you may remember, a couple months ago, we described as the Rasputin of the Trump White House.
Who can forget that?
Yeah. Calling the strings, getting rid of people who she
She's got quite a winning streak going. She got rid of the national security president's national security advisor and staffers there and some other people. She's on a roll.
It used to be the FBI that vetted candidates for top jobs, but I think now it's effectively Laura Loomer.
Right-wing influencer.
Yeah.
And that certainly fits the influence part with her. She has the influence in the Oval Office. And,
with El Presidente.
Yeah. Well, this is not just some bureaucratic struggle. Our guest today, Larry Pfeiffer, who has worked at the highest levels of the intelligence community, the NSA, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the CIA, and so on. He says the council, what the NSA does is it listens in on people. It's the great eavesdropping and code-breaking agency of the government. It listens in and it can
signals intelligence.
It can stray as it has in the past, which is why legislation was developed to keep them within the guardrails. And the council, the general counsel at NSA, is the dog that barks when the agency is proposing to do something that may be in a gray zone of illegal.
Right. Exactly. And by the way, April Das did have expertise in the cyber area. She'd written a book about it. She was steeped in the cyber threats facing this country. So, one more intelligence professional who's driven from the government. Before we get to Larry, I just want to take a little moment to talk about how we've been accused here at Spy Talk of being pro bono lawyers for the CIA.
I never took a single law school course.
Right. And why would we work pro bono if we were going to work for the CIA?
No, we want to get paid.
I don't do anything pro bono. It certainly work related these days. But look, this came from our erstwhile friend, Jeff Morley, good guy, written a lot about intelligence, who's just, gone off the deep end with his obsession about the Kennedy assassination. And it would be kind of quaint and fun, to occasionally listen to, but mostly ignore. But he's had some real influence in getting this congresswoman from Florida, Congresswoman Luna, who chairs the Secrets Committee of the House, digging into deep state Primes.
And for years before that, he's chipped away at CIA foot dragging on the Kennedy assassination and so on. But recently, it's his guns have turned on the CIA in a way that really wasn't done before, accusing them of being, along with the Pentagon, by the way, threw them into being the intellectual authors of the Kennedy assassination. And we took after him and the Washington Post for trumpeting his views without proper vetting last week. And we're going to continue to chip away at.
Well, we may have a debate, correct?
That's right. We've invited Jeff Morley to come on this podcast and to defend his views about the Kennedy assassination. Don't get me wrong. We'd love to see the CIA involved in the Kennedy assassination from a journalistic point of view. You know, that would be a really exciting story. And neither of us, both of us, I should say, have expressed skepticism and put the CIA under rigorous examination over the decades. But there's no evidence that the CIA was involved in the Kennedy assassination.
Picky, picky, picky. Anyway, stay tuned to Spy Talk for details on what may be our SmackDown WME-style debate between Spy Talk and Jeff Morley on the Kennedy.
That'll be an exciting day.
All right.
So without further ado, we're going to bring in Larry Pfeiffer, who's not only held senior-most positions at the National Security Agency, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and the CIA, where he was chief of staff, but he's run the White House Situation Room. Today, Pfeiffer is director of the Michael V. Hayden Center for Intelligence Policy and International Security at George Mason University, just outside Washington, D.C. So, Larry, you are no stranger to scandal and controversy in the intelligence community. There was the WMD, let's call it scandal, you know, over non-existent nuclear, biological, chemical weapons in Iraq. And then when you arrived with General Hayden at CIA, if I'm not mistaken, back in 2006, there was a yellow crime scene tape around the offices because of the
across the hall, yes.
because of some miscreants there. So what do you think of what's going on from 30,000 feet today in the intelligence community? Will the intelligence professionals be able to weather what's going on today or not?
Well, that's a fundamentally serious question you ask, because I and many of my colleagues are very worried about what's happening in the intelligence community, the pressure that's being put on them to perhaps put loyalty to the president above loyalty to the Constitution. At the end of the day, I do believe we have an intelligence community populated by patriotic Americans who swore an oath to protect the country from threats, both foreign and domestic. And I think the vast majority of them are going to do the right thing. When you have to pay the mortgage and pay the kids' school tuitions or sports fees and buy expensive groceries, when you're in the middle of your career where you have your entire retirement package is on the line, it's tricky. At a minimum, I think you're going to have a bunch of people burrowing in, maybe pulling punches, maybe avoiding working in the more controversial, subject areas that
like
get them in trouble.
Russia, you mean? Is that what you mean?
Like Russia, but even some of the others, Iran, China, I've seen it happen before where very talented, very good people who should be working the hardest problems will go and, find a quiet little corner of the agency for a couple of years to get out of the limelight so that they can avoid any of the controversy that might surround it.
So the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, recently put out some material and press statements accusing the former director of the CIA, John Brennan, the former director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, the former director of the FBI, James Comey, and President Obama of being involved in a treasonous conspiracy. what do you make of language like that? And what do you make of the substance of what she and others in the Trump administration are trying to point to somehow vindicate themselves on the Russia matter?
Well, first off, it's completely unprecedented for the leader of an intelligence community like Tulsi Gabbard or John Ratcliffe to get out there and publicly weigh in on such political issues, or to get out there and make statements that people are treasonous and need, you know, we're conducting coups and need to be prosecuted and, all of that. Absolutely unprecedented. That's not the job of the head of the intelligence community. It's not the job of the head of the CIA. You know, their job is to manage organizations that are going to produce intelligence information for the president of the United States to help the president make hard decisions around the hardest problems. So that was really uncalled for, and paints the intel community, paints the CIA in political tones that just undermine the credibility of those agencies to segments of the American population.
Is there some responsibility or ability of the workforce, the longtime professionals at the agency, at the CIA, let's say, to fight back? You've been in the bureaucracy, the intelligence bureaucracy, for your entire career. Is the usual way I learned in the military, if you don't want to do something, you just foot drag, right?
Yeah. There can be foot dragging. There can be foot dragging. Number one. Number two, they can do like I mentioned before and go find a quiet corner of the agency to avoid the controversy. They can decide it's time to go get their graduate degree and seek out some kind of fellowship or scholarship to get away. They can take a detail to another agency to get out of the limelight. And then the other thing that has happened in the past, and you guys know this better than I, they can go and quietly talk to reporters and let them know what's going on. There are whistleblower mechanisms in place that they can report concerns to, internal inspectors generals. The intelligence oversight committees. Normally you'd have mechanisms at the White House and the president's intel advisory board and the intel oversight board that would be avenues to report these things. And you have the Privacy and Civil Liberty Oversight Board as well. Now, in the current administration, some of those mechanisms are being led by people that are maybe not going to be interested in hearing what someone has to say if it's against the current administration. In some cases, they lack leadership because they've not replaced the people. The board members are not fully populated, so some of these boards can't operate. And you have congressional committees that are, in my view, completely derelict in their responsibilities to check the power of the executive branch. As my great mentor, General Hayden, has often said, there's two things the American people don't like historically. It's secrecy and power. And there's nothing more secret or powerful than some of these intelligence agencies we have. And so it's been vitally important that there be checks and mechanisms to, keep those agencies from abusing the powers that they have been.
So what are you hearing from your former colleagues in the intelligence community about the way things are playing out right now and statements like Gabbard has made?
So, first off, most of them don't even want to talk about it. they would rather not engage. They don't want to have any perception that they're out there causing trouble.
It's like, what more is there to say? I mean, you read yesterday, I'm sure, about John Ratcliffe scotching the appointment of Tom Sylvester, the former head of the National Clandestine Service, who has been described as the greatest case officer of his generation,
who was
getting this, typically honorary appointment as London station chief as the nice goodbye, thank you after a long, distinguished career. And he was denied that job, obviously out of political reasons.
Well, and, putting aside the laudatory celebratory nature of that kind of an assignment, that is the kind of assignment where you want to put your best analyst or your best case officer to engage, you know, one of our best partners, the Brits. So, you know, we're depriving ourselves of perhaps a better engagement with an important partner by not having him go there.
And the same day, I should point out, April Das, who was the general counsel of the NSA, yeah, your old agency, Larry, gets fired for the apparent reason that she had once worked for Mark Warner, the Democratic senator from Virginia on intelligence matters.
But
and former chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee.
But that was at a time when that committee was boasting of their great bipartisanship. So we're punishing somebody who was a key participant in ensuring that that committee produced a bipartisan report in that Sissy report on Russian influence in the election. I would also say that it's a little worrisome. The NSA general counsel position, and as well as most of the general counsel positions in the intel community, have been career professionals, people steeped in national security law. National security law is a very unique and different kind of law. It's very complicated. It's very complex. And particularly at NSA, you know, it touches on issues of civil liberties protection on an hour-by-hour, minute-by-minute basis. And so I worry a little bit that they've pulled away somebody who is steeped in that kind of expertise. And it raises questions as to, you know, what are they up to? What are they thinking of doing? Are they wanting to put somebody in that job who may be more willing to
tell the boss what he wants?
Yeah, tell the boss what he wants, or allow or order the agency, or tell the agency to do the things that the boss may want him to do that might be otherwise illegal. And getting back to your earlier question, when you talk about the employees and, you know, why are we not seeing, for example, mass resignations or something? I'm hard pressed to pick anything that Radcliffe or Gabbard has done as being illegal. I think some of it's borderline.
That's a low bar.
I think it's borderline amoral. But you probably have a lot of officers who say, "Well, it's not illegal, and so is this the petard I'm going to throw myself down upon and expose myself to criticism, to right-wing persecution, to losing my retirement." So I think a lot of people are.
I think some would argue that, you know, throwing out phrases, accusing people of being part of a treasonous conspiracy definitely has a McCarthy-esque rhyme to it.
And McCarthy didn't go to jail.
Jail. He just became a drunk and died.
After being censored. I think you have folks inside those agencies who are probably, as you said it, you know, establishing a pretty low bar in terms of, well, I'll just stick it out. But if they ever do anything illegal, or in particular, if they ever make me do something that I think is illegal, that may be the line. I sure hope that's at a minimum the line where most intel officers are putting themselves.
Well, what about the substance of what they've been trying to point to, which is reinvestigating and raising questions about the intelligence community assessment in late 2016, early 2017, ordered by then President Obama, that, according to the note put out by John Radcliffe, it was a rush job, had too much high level pressure, and did in some respects rely on the Steele dossier. Comey was pressing to have it in. Brennan, even though his own agent said, "We can't trust any of this, we don't know what the sourcing is," agreed to have it in a classified annex. Do they have a legitimate complaint there?
Well, lots of questions there. So, number one, rush job. Hey, you know, when the President of the United States says, "I want a report done, I want it done by the time I leave office," you know, you're gonna do a report by the time he leaves office. And, you know, I think President Obama had some legitimate concerns as to why that all of that information needed to be memorialized before he left office. Number two, I think the IC note that Radcliffe put out, despite everything you said, it also says we don't question any of the integrity of the judgments that were made.
That got lost in the coverage.
You know,
it did question the was there evidence to support that Putin ordered this to help Donald Trump?
Well, I think the question
that
there was
part of it.
I think the question there was, should it have been high confidence or medium confidence?
Right. You know,
I am sure if that report had come out and said medium confidence, we'd be all having the same conversations that we would have been having if it said high confidence.
Right.
I also believe that from everything I've heard from John Brennan in particular, there was some incredibly sensitive human-derived intelligence that drove that finding that was not made available to as large a segment of the analysts that would normally have been given access because of the sensitivity. And I think, ultimately that drove that final decision towards the confidence. Now I say that not, of course, not having seen any of it. I really don't know, but.
Well, there were news reports.
Is it 100 angels dancing on the head of a pin or is it 50 angels dancing on the head of a pin? I think we still have angels dancing on the head of a pin here. So,
well, there's been reporting that the CIA had a source in or around the Kremlin supplying some inside dope on Russian influence operations, so on. Then there's signals intelligence and so on that picked up the bot farm operations.
Right.
I go back to the late Sandy Grimes, who just died this past week, who was one of the legendary mole hunters at CIA. And I was on a panel with her years ago, and she said that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, a former senior KGB officer said to her, you guys had two stations in Moscow, one in your embassy and one in our KGB. So we've had some penetration of the Russian services over the years.
They've had some penetration as well.
And they, it's really Spy versus Spy, Mad Magazine.
Yeah, absolutely. The toughest counterintelligence problem that we have even to this day.
Back to my question, though, Larry, the third element was the Steele dossier and the role that it played.
So the Steele dossier, again, the way I see that story being having been played out is you had James Comey and the FBI wanting to make sure the Steele dossier played in the ICA in some fashion. I mean, I think there's some truth to Jim Comey saying, hey, look, the president told us to put everything we have in this document, so we need to account for the Steele dossier somehow, because if we don't, then we're going to be accused of having hid that from the president. If you recall at the time, that Steele dossier had been made available to a bunch of reporters around town. Maybe you guys had gotten it. I don't know. It took a while to make its way into official Washington. I don't remember all the specific details, but I remember John McCain, I think, had gotten a copy. I think John McCain made it available to some senior officials in the government.
Comey directly.
Yeah. So by the time it lands in official Washington, it was pretty late in the game, and there was no time, particularly no time if you wanted to get this report out before, January 20th, there was no time for the intel community or the FBI to vet those sources any better than they did. So, and you also saw where the FBI was going to withdraw themselves from the ICA and if it was not included in some fashion. So the compromise that was reached was, we'll make it an annex. We will also clearly note that the analysis and findings of the ICA did not have nothing from the Steele dossier contributed to the analytic findings of the report. Now, we do see references to a fourth bullet in the most super sensitive version of this document that went to a smaller handload of people in the Obama administration that said something along the lines of, for additional information about Russian activities, see Annex A. Again, you go to then see Annex A, and Annex A says right up front, here's a summary of what we got. We've had limited ability to corroborate this information, but but here it is to let you know. And it also says nothing in this annex was used in the findings of the document. So I think people are making way too much about that fourth bullet in the super sensitive secret document, by which, by the way, has not been declassified and has not been put out there by anybody. So
I think the argument would be that the dossier sort of set a template of expectations of people. Among people, when the Mueller investigation gets launched, people are viewing it in the context of the claims laid out in that document about this close collusive relationship between the Kremlin and the Trump campaign and Trump himself.
The ICA makes no judgments about whether the Trump campaign was working in concert with Putin and all that either. You know, the FBI is a tricky member of the intel community because they're at their heart and soul a law enforcement organization. And I think from an intelligence perspective, I think the intelligence community handled the Steele dossier as well as they could handle it, given FBI's concerns about it being put in there. You know, and you see interviews with Comey after the fact when he talks about briefing Trump and, you know, how painful it was to bring up the dossier and how Trump reacted to it.
Can I just say, I have a different take on that now, having read that CIA note and have it confirmed by Sue Miller, former chief of CIA counterintelligence, that Comey was so pushing the dossier and to the point where he was going to withdraw the FBI from the intelligence system and all. You go a few days later to that meeting on January 6th at Trump Tower, where he's staying back and then presents it with him. It now looks to me like he was probably doing that as an investigative technique because he believes it. He believes it might be true. And he wants to see how his target, the president of the United States, reacts when he shows him the stuff about the P tape in the Steele dossier.
So I again go back to my statement about the FBI relationship with the, you know, as being part of the intel community, but mainly being a law enforcement agency gets pretty tricky. But as you remember from the January 6th meeting, Comey stayed behind. And I think that was a collegial decision on the part of the true intel bubbas and Comey, that the intel bubbas were like, we're out of here. Yeah. You're on your own. Have fun. And that's how it kind of went from there.
Can you imagine Comey pulling out handcuffs?
No, I can't.
We're going to take a quick break right now, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Okay, we're back. We have to bring up a painful chapter here. Quite tiresome, I'm sure. The Hunter Biden laptop.
Ambush time.
And the advertiser.
All right, Pfeiffer, fess up.
So I signed the letter at the time. I was one, you know, they talk about the 51 people who signed it. Everybody forgets that there were actually several others who signed it, but anonymously. So there were more of us.
Lucky them.
Can you identify those people for us?
I'd have to go back and look at emails to see if I could even remember who they were, but you know, there were others.
And who was the chief organizer from your point of view, who was the chief organizer of that?
It was Morrell, saying the 100. Mike Morrell, I think.
Well, so, I want to hear from Larry.
Yeah, okay. So I'm trying to remember if my initial email on it was from Michael Morrell, but the three people that I engaged most, four people I engaged most in those immediate days around signing the letter were Morrell, Mark Polymeropoulos, Kristen Wood, Shapiro, mm-hmm. Nick Shapiro. And Michael did most of the drafting. I think Mark contributed some. I think others also offered comments on the draft. Nick was the guy who knew the reporters to get in touch with and share it that way. I'm sitting probably in my office, checking my email. I get an email that says, hey, we got this letter. Would you be interested in signing it? It's public record that in those emails it said, hey, and by the way, we think this will help Biden, give him a talking point at the debate that's coming up. As a private citizen, believe me, I was pretty vocal at the time supporting Biden over Donald Trump. I saw Donald Trump as a danger to the Republic back then and as much as I do today. So that there's no being bashful or shy about that. But the way the letter was written, it didn't come out and endorse a candidate. It didn't say, go vote for Joe Biden. I mean, it was a warning to the American voting people that we, given our expertise from the past, given what had happened in 2016, given what had been reported in the press leading up to the election, we felt that the placement of those emails in the American media that close to the election had smacked of Russian
hallmarks.
I think it said hallmarks or earmarks or whatever. We never said the laptop was fake. In fact, I think we said the laptop and the emails may very well be real. In fact, the fact that they are and were real smacks even more of a Russian information operation, because most Russian information operations, most good information operations have some base in truth.
Wait a second. You're not still suggesting that the Russians had a role in the Hunter Biden laptop, because it's been authenticated by the FBI. Again, it was used as court testimony in federal court.
Parts of it were used in testimony.
Yeah, well, right.
And the parts that were used in testimony in court were the parts that the FBI definitely could validate, because they had this laptop in their hands.
Right.
Yeah, honestly, to this day, and granted, you'd think I'd follow this like assiduously and moment by moment, but I don't. But most, I won't say most, several of us who signed the letter haven't seen anything to completely refute the idea that the Russians played some role in that material.
But there's absolutely no evidence that they did. And so when you don't have evidence that they did, is it even fair to raise the prospect that something might have happened when you can't back it up?
Well, we I think said in the letter that we had no hard evidence, but what we were seeing and what we were hearing and what we had seen reported in the press led us to feel the need to warn the American people that that something was up. And I think I'll just leave it at that. So, John Cypher wrote a wonderful article for somebody a couple of months back that, you know, laid out, and he had that podcast, as well. That
John Cypher was a senior CIA officer, and ran Russia operations for CIA at one point.
Right. So he's written extensively in recent months, and he has also had some podcast episodes in recent months that definitely, I think, still raise questions as to whether there was a Russian role in that material making its way to the press. And frankly, even whether or not some version of the laptop, because there were multiple versions of this hard drive out there, you know, what the New York Post reported on wasn't the actual laptop. It was a copy of the hard drive that some who've analyzed that have said showed clear, definite manipulation of the data on the copy of the hard drive they'd seen. So it still raises questions in my mind.
So you're saying, to clarify, you're saying that as far as you're concerned, and some of your former CIA brethren, mm-hmm. there's still the possibility that there was a Russian hand in the laptop incident. Is that what you're saying?
I think it's possible. Now, of course, we're going to make headlines, and now I'm going to probably get attacked by thousands of crazy.
That's our job here.
Nuts. So thank you very much, guys. But
let me put it this way: if you had a chance to do it over again, would you still sign that letter?
There's one.
Even though that nothing has come out that has supported the idea that this was a Russian operation.
Well, again, I think you go and look at what John Cypher's written. Go look at what it was on his podcast. And I think there's definitely smoke, and where there's smoke, there's sometimes to be fire.
I mean, the
well,
quotes.
I'm sorry, that smacks of, you know, WMD, mushroom clouds and all that stuff. You know, we have this piece of evidence and that piece of evidence. And therefore Saddam Hussein has a nuclear weapon. I'm sorry, but, you know, it seems to be the same analytical process.
Analytic rigor, yeah. Larry.
I mean, we're very clear. We're very clear in the letter that these were a bunch of private citizens with experience about how Russia's intelligence service operates.
You're not just private citizens. You are former senior CIA officers.
No different than general officers writing letters supporting Donald Trump. It's no different than scientists from both sides of the spectrum writing letters supporting one candidate or the other regarding what they thought about COVID. You know, it's no different. And we didn't disclose any classified information. We didn't expose any classified information. We just said, based on our experience and our knowledge, which, you know, hey, as a voter, I love it when I see a bunch of former whatevers come out and write letters and write op-eds that talk about what, you know, based on their experience. You know, they can illuminate and shed light on an issue based on their experience and knowledge.
People infer, however, from you. You can parse it any way you want about, you know, we didn't use any classified information, yada, yada, yada. But people infer that because of your position, you have some inside dope, that you have some scintilla of proof.
I think we underestimate the intellect of most Americans. I think most Americans looked at that letter and said, here's a bunch of former guys weighing in. I mean, if you read the letter, that's what we all, I mean, when people were criticizing and jumping all over us, like they were particularly, well, ever since the letter came out, it seems that they've never wanted to let go. You know, our answer most often is just go read the letter. If you read the letter, it really doesn't say the things.
Yeah, read the fine print.
Yeah, Mark Zaid's defense is the letter really doesn't say anything because we didn't say it is Russian disinformation. We just said it has the hallmarks.
All right, we've beaten you up enough on the Hunter. We've beaten you over the head with a Hunter Biden laptop. We didn't mean to go on and on about it. But,
and I'm going to just turn things here, you know, because I haven't had a chance to mention this, but that declassification of the HPSI report, I have in my
House Intelligence Committee.
Yeah, the House Intelligence Committee report that Tulsi Gabbard allowed the declassification, light declassification of. I read through that the other day, and I almost felt like I was going to get in trouble for having read that document, the amount of detail that remained in that document about tactic, techniques, procedures, you know, sources and methods could be easily inferred in almost every instance with the light redactions. I mean, I don't know if I've seen a document of that sensitivity so lightly redacted, a document that was so sensitive that CIA says, hey, House, you do your work here in our building and you can't take that thing out of the building because it's so super classified.
And well, do you think, are you saying that the declassification put sources and methods at risk?
I think so. It put liaison relationships at risk. And if it doesn't put the immediate sources at risk, because let's say we exfiltrated the source out of Russia or whatever, it absolutely discourages anybody in any sensitive position in a foreign government from coming to one of our case officers and saying, hey, I would love to share some information with you because I don't like the guys who are running my country. There's definitely some concerns that we're going to lose our ability to collect information from those people because of this kind of gratuitous exposure.
Was there anything in particular that jumped out at you in that report that was dangerous? It shouldn't have been in the public?
Well, I think there's exhaustive detail about the source of him or herself. And I think there is some very, very light protection of a liaison service in the document as well, which I think is, you know, inappropriate. There are very careful procedures that are in place for declassifying or redacting or sanitizing material. Your colleague, Olivia Gazis, over at CBS News did a great article last week that talked about how this HPSI report was handled. And it was handled in a way to get around that process. So it's sitting in a safe at CIA for sources and methods reasons. The first step in the process is the House requests that document be brought to the House and stored there. So it's not a question of classification, it's just we want to store it. And so John Ratcliffe says, you know what? Yeah, sure. Let's pass it over to the House and you guys can have it. So they then get it. It's probably stored in a nice safe in the vault. It's at the House. You know, that's great. But then they go to DNI Gabbard and say, okay, DNI Gabbard, we would like to declassify this. Now, DNI Gabbard, given the way our classification and declassification process works, is not really able to do that on her own. So she the normal process is that would be farmed back out to CIA, and at CIA, it would go to the DO, the operations directorate, for them to review for, you know, sources and methods issues. That didn't happen. According to this article, she went to the president and said, this needs to be declassified. I've had my staff, probably her director's initiative group, a bunch of people that none of us know that probably came from outside the intel community, and they did a very light redaction. And they gave it to the president for him to then, you know, given his inherent authorities over classification, to bless. So that they did an end run around careful procedures that were put in place to protect.
So do you think Trump read this and had a direct hand in?
Didn't read it? No, I think. No. Well, I mean, I'm only
hard to imagine.
I'm just relaying what the article, the CBS News article said.
All he wanted to hear was the treasonous conspiracy claim. That's all he needed.
Speaking of treason, can I ask a question here? We've done some reporting on the greater risk of intelligence community members committing treason, selling documents or their information to a hostile foreign intelligence agency. One of our authoritative sources on moles said there is an actuarial certainty that 1% overall time, that 1% of IC employees will commit treason to one level or another.
Let's say commit espionage instead of treason.
Commit, but yeah. Thank you. Espionage. Yeah. We'll sell what they know.
Yep.
And that may have been increased by 0.5% or even a full percent more to 2%, which would amount to hundreds, if not thousands, of employees. Is that something you and your intelligence community brethren are worried about?
Well, I've heard about in my career the actuarial numbers you suggest that that we just assume there's a very small percentage, but a percentage of people that are betraying their country on a day-to-day basis, and that's shameful, but it happens. Could there be greater risk today of that happening? It's a worry, absolutely. I guarantee you, the Chinese, Russian, Iranian, probably Israeli, intel services are working overtime in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere to try to get access to individuals, particularly individuals who maybe were fired for what they would easily argue was no cause. Again, I'm not trying to impugn the character of individuals who've been fired, but I think evidence has shown that people will do things they would never, ever think to do if they find themselves in dire conditions. They don't have money to pay a mortgage. They got a sick kid. They got, whatever. Or, could they just be disgruntled? That Trump guy pisses me off. I'll show him and I'll go, sell secrets to the Chinese. It's definitely a concern and a worry that the risk has gone up. The surface vulnerability has definitely increased in size for sure.
I just got one more subject I wanted to throw out. You ran the White House Situation Room.
I did.
You were dealing with international crises as they happened. When you look at this administration, this White House, the National Security Council, the handling, no shortage of crises: Iran, Gaza, Russia, Ukraine. How do you assess they are handling the management of an international crisis, which is what you had to do when you were?
Yeah. So I worked at the White House running the sit room, which was part of the National Security Council staff at a time when the National Security Council staff probably had reached its apex in size. And we can all argue, what the size of an NSC should be. Many argued that that was too large of a size and that you had too much micromanagement happening from the NSC staff. I would argue today you have the exact opposite. You've had a gutting of the NSC staff. I'm not certain where crisis management is truly happening in the government today. There's also the NSC historically, well, I'd say for much of the last 50 years or more, has had a robust interagency process managed by the NSC to ensure that the president is getting the information he needs to make these hard decisions in a timely manner, and that everybody's viewpoints are being appropriately brought to his attention. It does not appear that this president, both in the first term, but even more so in the second term, is using the interagency process managed by his own staff. No,
hardly. He turns on a dime. I mean, right. The switch on Ukraine, for example. Yeah. Vlad was my friend, but my wife told me, well, he's bombing Ukrainian cities, so he's not your friend. Oh, okay. So, boy, I'm huffing and he's like the huff and puff, wolf is I'm blow your house down in 50 days. Oh, wait a minute. 10 days. I meant. So,
I will say that, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Kane, is a solid citizen, and I'm sure he's doing his god awful best to make sure the president's getting good advice. I think Marco Rubio, despite his loss of soul, perhaps, is still a fairly smart individual and has been working national security issues for a long time. So I'd still like to believe that in his role as Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, he's also a more often than not a sensible voice. But I do worry that decisions could be being slowed down. Without the interagency process, the president can be prone to advice from, family members, as you suggest, or from whoever talks to him last, which I think we've all seen reflections of in the press that that's often how he makes his decisions. So, yeah. We've built an interagency process, a national security process, over the last 50, well, since John F. Kennedy was president, that was intended to ensure the president could make informed decisions as quickly as possible. I mean, it was, when I used to brief people, dignitaries that would come in to see the Situation Room, we'd go into that large JFK conference room and I'd just look at them and go, this is the place where the hardest decisions in the world get made on a routine basis. And our job at the Situation Room is to make sure that these people who are making these decisions have the information they need when they need it in a timely manner. And they're doing it in a setting that affords them the opportunity to communicate rapidly with anyone they need to communicate at any time. And I feel that robust capability that I think gave American policymakers decision advantage over any other leader in the world, I think it's been broken to our peril.
I have to thank you for that. I think that's a very good summation of the role of the Situation Room, and it depends so much on the president himself of how it runs.
Oh yeah.
So,
yeah, absolutely.
I couldn't help but notice when you talked about espionage threats to the United States, you include the Israelis.
Well, they're a foreign intel service. You can't trust anybody. I'm in that business. We're the guys that, right. we smell flowers and we ask where's the right. funeral. So.
Well, there's the old saw that there are friendly countries, there are no friendly intelligence agencies. But there's been reporting, another flare-up of reporting on Israeli penetration of the White House itself. During your time, whether at the ODNI or NSA or CIA, you were in a position to know about whether the Israelis had bugged the White House or other critical facilities, national security facilities.
During my time there, nobody had bugged the White House. After I left, we had the whole story about potential bugging of the White House.
And you know that because you undertook an investigation.
Right. So I mean, what I will say is that there are robust detection equipment and robust countermeasures in place to try to ensure that the most sensitive places in the White House are protected. But we can't guarantee that the most sensitive conversations in the White House always happen in the most sensitive places.
What are we talking about? What bugging by who was discovered after you left?
Not bugging physically, but I think there was, I'd have to dig through the archives, but there was some story about Russian activity of intercepting communications in the government. I think State Department, maybe White House.
The bugs on the seventh floor.
Cyber attacks.
But yeah, I was talking about the Israelis.
An actual placement of a bug? No, I'm not aware of any bug ever being placed. And if it was placed, I think it would be immediately detected.
There were reports that the Israelis had bugged the White House or adjacent facilities. Did you look into that?
I don't remember the details. During my time at the White House, I don't recall that at all. And after you leave, it's somebody else's problem. But intelligence service, spooks are going to spy. That's what we do. I mean, there are relationships that are more trusted than others. And so maybe, the second party relationships, as we refer to them, the Five Eyes relationships, those are ones where, are we spying on each other? Probably not. But I say probably because, you can't trust anybody. It was interesting, working at NSA and working at CIA, we all talk about the great Five Eyes relationship. But the Five Eyes relationship was a definitely more meaningful thing at NSA than it was at CIA.
Yeah. So finally, to wrap this up, this has been great, Larry. Thanks for all your time. You've seen some recent reporting on the front page of the Washington Post was a story that strongly implied the CIA was involved in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Were you part of the cover-up, Larry, when you were there, or?
I read Michael Isikoff, and so I know the real scoop on this story. So let me put it this way. When I worked at NSA and I worked at CIA, and I was in the intel community 32 years, I never found anything that would have ever said that CIA was involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. I never found the aliens in the basement. I never found any of that. Now, did the intel community do things we shouldn't have done in our history? Absolutely. And that's going to, color American trust of the intel community for all time. I mean, it's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. But I do believe that post-Church, post-Pike Commission in the 70s, when, much of that bad activity was exposed, I do think the intel community has operated under the law with rare exception. And those rare exceptions are when people misbehave, not the institutions misbehave. That's my personal view.
Well, it's the rare exceptions that keep us going. So,
well, and you can be perfect. You can be perfect 365 days of a year. You screw up one day of the year, and that's what colors it in everybody's mind. And I think the intel community knows that. So,
Larry Pfeiffer, this has been terrific. Thanks for coming on the show.
All right. I appreciate coming on here. I'm not going to appreciate all the Hunter Biden laptop crap I'm probably about to get. But it is what it is.
You'll survive. You'll survive.
Well, so far I've survived. Yep.
Okay.
All right. Thank you,
gentlemen. Thanks a lot.
So long. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't done so already, do check out the SpyTalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. MSW Media.
It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.